Do a little bit of background to what we are doing here, so that you understand what is happening. So what we are, I started off this retreat by talking a little bit in general about the suttas and about the Buddha's teaching. So we spent a day or even 2 days doing just that. And then we started looking at the gradual training. I think we only started a couple of days ago. And the idea of the gradual training is that it is the complete path of practice from the very beginning all the way to the end. So really exciting stuff, right? You get the whole lot, the whole thing there, which is great. And this, of course, shadows very closely. It goes together with the Noble Eightfold Path. So the gradual training, in many ways, is an expansion of the Noble Eightfold Path. And we have been looking at the first few factors of that path. So we have been looking at how right view as the first factor of the path, how that arises, how from right view comes the right aim, the right purpose, the right intention, samma sankappa, on the path. In other words, you start heading in the right direction. And once you start heading in the right direction, then the first aspect of that is the morality. So we have been looking at right action and also right speech. And now today we're going to start moving on to, well, this next part here is called contentment on the in the gradual training, and it's roughly similar to right livelihood, if you like, on the Noble Eightfold Path, and also moving on to the mind itself, how to deal with the mind and how to make the mind peaceful and perceive in the right way and intend in the right way, all of these kind of things. Yeah, so that is what we're doing. So it's all very nice, all very inspiring stuff, all straight from the Buddha himself, which I always find very inspiring, especially when you delve a little bit into it and you try to understand more deeply what actually is going on. So we are now on page 14. The sutta what we're looking at is Majjhima Nikaya 27, the shortest sutta on the simile of the elephant's footprint is the name of the sutta, for those of you who haven't been here. And we are now down to paragraph 5 in the sutta, where it says he becomes content with robes, etc. That's where we are at now. And as you can see, I have left out again the small part there. You see the little dots on the side, and if you're interested in kind of the details left out, I recommend you to have a look at this for yourself. But I have focused on what I consider the most important aspects here for the purpose of this particular retreat. That's why I have left a few things out. So now we are coming to the little part which is called contentment here, and it is roughly equivalent to right livelihood on the Noble Eightfold Path, and this is how it reads. He becomes content with robes to protect his body and with alms food to maintain his stomach, and wherever he goes he sets out taking only these with him. Just as a bird, wherever it goes, flies with its wings as its only burden, so too the bhikkhu becomes content with robes to protect his body and with alms food to maintain his stomach. And wherever he goes, he sets out, taking only these with him. Possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, he experiences within himself a bliss that is blameless. So this is the little thing on contentment, and the reason why I say it is equivalent to right livelihood. You may wonder, what has this got to do with livelihood, right? But the reason is because the livelihood of the monk is his bowl, his alms bowl. And you walk around, you collect alms, just like in lay life, obviously you have to, you work for a salary. As a monk, you kind of do your practice and you collect alms. That's the way you survive as a monk. So this is kind of your livelihood, and it's roughly equivalent to that. But of course, there's much more going on here than just the idea of livelihood. There's also this whole idea of being content with simple things, right? Content with something very easy. And the idea of contentment, of course, is that we have now been looking at actions of body and speech, which are the kind of the external way of morality. And now we are moving gradually from the external morality into the internal and mental aspect of morality itself. So that is what contentment is. It's the beginning of the morality of the mind that we're seeing here. Because obviously, if you are content, what does that mean? It means you don't have too many desires, right? When you haven't got too many desires, you haven't got that much restlessness, you haven't got so much agitation, you also have much less ill will and anger, because desire and ill will are two very closely connected aspects of the mind. So these things often go together. So for this reason, what we're seeing here is a movement from the external morality to the mental morality, which is such an important part of the Buddhist path. And the beginning of that is this idea of just being content, right? And it's very beautiful. One of the great things about the monastic life, we're here talking about the monastic life. This does not mean that this is not relevant for lay people. It's relevant for everybody. It would be terrible if I came here and just talked about monastic stuff, because it's supposed to be for everyone, right? So it is for you, for everyone here as well. But there is something very nice about the monastic life, in the sense that if you are content with just an alms bowl and a robe and nothing else, and one of the things about monastic life is that you're not really allowed to ask for very much, you're not even allowed to ask for an extra bowl, you're not allowed to ask for new robes, except for very special circumstances, if you lose your robes, that kind of stuff. You're not allowed to ask for special foods, any of these things. And what all of that means, that after a while, because you can't get it anyway, really, right? You can't ask for these things, except if your robe is falling apart or something. It means that after a while you just settle down and you accept whatever comes to you, whatever is given to you. You're fine with that. You don't worry about things. You don't think about what could I possibly have, because you can't really get it anyway. There's not much point in thinking about those things. This is the ideal way of the monastic life, right? Where you kind of just allow things to be. You don't think about anything, and you just are very content with very simple things in life. And the monastic rules support that entire outlook. That entire way of being is supported by the monastic rules. And here you have this beautiful simile, what a monk is supposed to be like, or a nun is supposed to be like. It's like the bird that flies with its wings as its only burden. Right? Just like a bird. It's like a sense of freedom when you are a bird. You can go wherever you like, because there's nothing that really ties you down. You're not attached to anything. The bird doesn't have any particular home, any place that it considers its own. But you move around, and all you carry with you are your wings. Well, the wings are kind of part of you anyway, right? There's not much of a problem. In the same way, the ideal monastic is someone who is not really tied down to anything, but moves around with bowl and robe and nothing else. Right? It's a kind of this ideal of freedom. It's a different kind of freedom than we normally think about. But there's a certain freedom of that, a freedom of non-attachment, non-desire that you're seeing here. And these days, it's quite hard to find monastics who really live up to this standard. Right, I don't know if I should say this, but I think I have said it already, so I might as well repeat it, I suppose. But when I came here, I brought my own laptop, right? That is slightly embarrassing when you read this passage, not really living up to the standards in the suttas. So sometimes you have to, the reason I have a laptop is simply so I can have all the suttas there, and I can do a few emails and these kind of things that you just have to do. But ideally, you know, it would be even better if I could just chuck out the laptop and then just come with bowl and robe, right? That would be even better in a way here. And I know that in Sri Lanka, there were some of the monks there who were very keen on following the Vinaya, following the suttas to the last letter. And what they would do, they wouldn't even have suttas with them. What they would do, they would memorize some of the key suttas and just carry them with them in the mind, right? No need for any laptops or anything else. And then they would just wander around with a bowl and robe, because everything they had, it was already with them. There was nothing else that was really required. And it's really nice when you can live up to these standards fully. But sometimes you have to find a little bit of a middle way here, in this way here. So this is the idea of contentment. Live a simple life for monastics and then be happy with that. It cuts away so much desire, so much papansha, so much proliferation, so much thinking about how what the world might be like, right? But I must admit, if I wanted a life full of luxury, I would just go back to lay life. You know, my family is plenty wealthy enough, you know, there wouldn't have been a problem with that. So why I should seek for these kind of things as a monastic is beyond me. It doesn't make any sense at all. So it's actually very nice to forget about all of that. But it is not just for monastics, this thing. It is also for lay people as well. The idea is obviously slightly different, right? But the idea of being content with what you have, whether you have a lot or whether you have little, as long as you have enough to get by on, that is what really matters, right? You're not hungry, you're not walking around with kind of shabby clothes. You all look reasonably well dressed, so I think you're probably okay, right? So it is an idea here, is just to be happy with what you have. And when you do that, it doesn't matter, of course, whether you are wealthy or just average or whatever. You can be whatever. There's nothing wrong with being wealthy as such. But the problem is really to be content with what you have already. And there's something beautiful what happens in most people's life when they do that. It means that you have less ambition, less desire, less drive to achieve status, money, wealth, all of these kind of things that are worldly things, and they go against the stream of the Dhamma. The stream of the Dhamma is contentment, being peaceful, attaining this degree of happiness, which actually is far more pleasurable than any of these worldly things that you can achieve. It's a very, very beautiful idea, and it actually makes life so much more relaxing and at ease when we don't strive so much for all of these things in the world. So see if you can live like that. And the younger you are, the earlier on you kind of grasp the importance of these things, the easier and the more pleasing, pleasant your life is going to be as a consequence. The world is always kind of encouraging us on, right, to strive and to work hard. The whole kind of mentality of the world is like that. So you have to kind of think differently from the vast majority. You have to think in a different way, look at the world in a different way. So it's good sometimes to be a bit independent, right? Not follow what everyone else says. Everyone else, are they really happy? Not really, right? So why follow what they're saying? They kind of go probably going down the wrong track anyway. So you might as well be a bit independent and do things in a different way. And sometimes it's interesting. I always found that those people who are really, really happy in life are often the people who live really incredibly simple lives. People like Ajahn Brahm, he is incredibly happy. He goes around saying, oh, life is all dukkha, it's all bad. And then he has a big smile on his face, right? It's one of those weird things. So you go, Ajahn Brahm always tells the story of Ajahn Chah. He went once up to Ajahn Chah's little cutie, and he... Ajahn Chah at this time was incredibly famous in Thailand. He was one of the most famous monks in Thailand in the 20th century. To his funeral service back in 1992 or whenever it was, there was reckoned to be about 500,000 people coming to his funeral service. He probably wouldn't have been too happy if he saw that. Probably said, oh, why? Just go and meditate instead. You're wasting your time. But anyway, 500,000 people came to his funeral service. And so incredibly famous, the generals of the army would come and see him, government ministers, people would come from overseas, right? Professors from Sweden, from the US or whatever, they would all come to see this monk who was becoming very famous towards the end of his life. And then one day Ajahn Brahm went up, he was invited up into his kuti for some kind of conversation or something. And when you come into the kuti of Ajahn Chah, it was so simple. There was nothing there. Absolutely empty. There was like a bowl standing in the corner, like the alms bowl you're supposed to have as a monk. There was a robe, like a sanghati, the third robe of a monastic, draped over a rack, right? A simple kind of bamboo rack on the wall. And that was all. That was the entire life of Ajahn Chah. And he was, basically, when you're with him, that's what you hear from everyone, he was one of the most happy people imaginable. And he had nothing. And it shows you, again, you know, true happiness in the world is usually found in a very, very different place from what we think it is for the vast majority of people. I'm sure many of you know this already, but it's good to kind of get these things kind of reinforced a little bit. So contentment, right, with what we have is such a powerful and beautiful thing. It makes life so much more simple when we have this idea of contentment with little, contentment with few things. This is the beautiful part of this passage here. I remember when my friend Ajahn Sujato, he left Bodhidharma Monastery to go to Taiwan to translate the suttas. And when he leaves the monastery, he has one shoulder bag. That's all he has. And all his possessions are in that shoulder bag, and he's kind of off. It's quite nice. Anyway, so then we have this last sentence here, which says, possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, he experiences within himself a bliss that is blameless. Aggregate of noble virtue. This is one of the problems of translation, is that you come up with these weird expressions. Nobody in the world talks about aggregate of noble virtues. Only in a Buddhist text, it's the only place in the entire world you find these kind of expressions. This is why it is sometimes called Buddhist hybrid English. It's not real English, it's kind of a, you know, weird kind of English. So what it means basically is that, what it means is possessing, having this whole collection of virtues, right? That's really what it means. Aggregate in English usually means a pile of sand or something like that. That's usually what it means in English, at least in Australia. But here it means like having all of these various types of virtues that we have been talking about. Virtue of the body, virtue of speech, and now also virtue of the mind, right? When you have all of these virtues, you feel the bliss of blamelessness inside of you. I think that is better than the bliss that is blameless, the bliss of blamelessness, because you feel blameless. You feel that you're living well, right? And that is a certain amount of happiness in its own right, that nobody can really say anything about you. You know within your heart that you are living well. It means that you have a large amount of independence in the world. People criticize you, you don't take it so seriously anymore, because you know that you are living well. That is the bliss of blamelessness. You know that you're not doing the bad things. But also, as I said before, it is a mixture of not doing the bad things and then the happiness that comes from actually doing what is good. Because all of these things that we have seen so far is about both the negative side, not doing what is bad, and the positive side of doing what is good. And then you have the bliss of blamelessness. Yeah, and that is what we were talking about before when we're talking about this idea. You sit back, right, and you sit in your meditation. A lot of time when you try to meditate, oh, you're a bit tired or you're restless. And for those of you who maybe just come for the first day, maybe you were at work yesterday, I don't know, and maybe your mind is full of all kinds of things. And it takes a while for the mind to kind of settle down. But when the mind starts to settle down because you have done all the right things, it comes back to you, right? It kind of invades you. You can't stop yourself from being happy. You can't stop yourself from feeling content. Wow, actually, I am living quite well. You don't even think that thought. It's just that your mind kind of brightens up naturally as a consequence of the lifestyle that you're leading. There's a beautiful simile I was talking about yesterday, a simile of the mountain of good deed that envelops you and overshadows you and kind of encloses you within itself. All those good deeds envelop your mind and make you feel content and happy. And this is what this idea of the bliss of blamelessness is all about. And this is one of the things that you will see as you study the suttas. You will see that almost everything, everywhere, is about happiness, right? It's about the path leading from one degree of happiness to another one, higher and higher and higher, until eventually you achieve the ultimate, the highest happiness that is possible for a human being, or for any being for that matter. But it starts from the very beginning. The moment you start to think, yeah, I'm going to live better life. Already, that makes you feel a little bit happy. And then it continues all the way to the end of the path. Happiness increasing, suffering going down, right? These are two sides of the same coin, essentially, here. So that is the little passage on contentment. And I think it's a very important one to keep these things in mind. And it kind of, when we start living a more spiritual life, I think it is quite natural that we turn away from, from the worldly things a little bit, at least a little bit to begin with, and then move towards contentment in our life instead. And I also think it often has something to do with age, right? As you age, you tend to become more content with what you have. You get less kind of excited about, kind of building up stuff. When you're young, because it looks like your life is very long ahead of you, it is more difficult to kind of have that contentment when you're young. It's more kind of, tend to be more ambitious. And it's natural, these things. But of course, if you can get these things into your mind early on, then that is, of course, very powerful and very useful. Anyway, so now I want to move on to the next paragraph. Next paragraph is the famous paragraph on sense restraint, and this is also very, very, very important to understand this correctly. So a very core aspect of the gradual training, and I will talk about this in quite a lot of depth, and I will go over to some of the other suttas to explain what this really is about. So this is called sense restraint. Indriya sangvara sila in Pali, the sila, the morality of the restraint of the senses is what this is about. So let's see how this works. Now we are moving on to samma vayama or samma padana on the Noble Eightfold Path, right? The sixth factor. So we're kind of moving forward now. We're getting to the slightly more profound aspects of the path. But these are still aspects that are useful for all of us to know about. We're still not going so far that we are going into the very profound areas. These are still areas that are important for all of us to deal with. So I think most of you will find this quite interesting and quite useful and very practical. One of the great things about the Buddhist teachings, if we read them in the right way, they are extraordinarily practical and pragmatic teachings that we can really apply in our lives. And this is one of those very important things. I don't myself, a little bit of theory is nice, I don't mind that so much, but for me, of course, the whole point of this, the whole point of these teachings is how do we apply them in our lives. That is what makes me interested in these things, and theoretical aspects to me are very secondary here. So this is a very practical teaching, so this is how it goes. On seeing a form with the eye, he does not grasp at its signs and features, since if he left the eye faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade him. He practices the way of its restraint. He guards the eye faculty. He undertakes the restraint of the eye faculty. Yeah, so that is the basic formula, and you probably have some idea what is going on here, but it is not entirely obvious what all of these things mean, and I want to spend a little bit of time just explaining to you what actually is happening here. So, first of all, on seeing a form with the eye, right? What this means, it just means that you're seeing stuff. It doesn't really matter exactly what it is. A form here, Pali, what is it? Rupa, and rupa just means any sensory impression coming through the eye. Any vision you have, right, is part of form here. And when you see something with the eye, it says you do not grasp at its signs and features. Now this is far from obvious what that means. Signs and features here, the word for sign is nimitta. Nimitta, same as when we talk about samadhi nimitta, or a vision that you have in your meditation practice, the same word. So nimitta here means something like object, right? So when I see, what do I see? I see people, right? I see each one of you. I see a table. I see a camera in front of me here. I see clock over there. I see the air conditioning units in the ceiling here. These are like objects, right? And this is the nimitta in this particular case. So sign here is kind of It's just a very all-encompassing word, and that is why they use that instead of using another word like object or whatever. So that is really what it means. It means different objects. And of course, some of the most important objects in the world are other people. That's why I mentioned people straight away, right? These are some of the most important objects in life, because other people are the things that give rise to the most emotions inside of us, emotions of attachments, emotions of sometimes upset, emotions of desire, emotions of all kinds of jealousy, all kind of stuff that arises because of other people. So this is one of the most important aspects here when we talk about objects is other people. But of course, it can be anything included here. It can be anything that is desirable or that you are averse against, right? Anything really is part of this idea of objects. Object. And feature here, vyanjana, these are the kind of the subsidiary aspect of the object, right? So if you see a person, it might be, you know, the head or the legs or the feet or the hair or whatever it is, some aspect of the person. Or if it is a house, right, and it might be a particular object in the house or a sub-aspect or whatever it is. So these are the sub-aspects of a particular object. So really, what it really means is very, very straightforward, really. It means anything you are seeing, any aspect of that field that you are seeing, right? This is really all it means. Very simple. It sounds very kind of, a bit kind of deep and significant, but actually the answer is it's pretty straightforward. And so he does not grasp at these things. You don't grasp these objects or the subsidiary qualities in those objects. So what does it mean to grasp these things? Obviously, it does not mean physical grasping, because this is something you see with the eye. So what this is referring to is a mental type of grasping of things. How do we know that we have grasped something mentally? What is the how can we actually be aware of this? And the way that you are aware of that is simply through the reaction that your mind has to an object. Yeah, so when you see somebody and that image of that person kind of sticks in your mind afterwards, either because of desire or because of aversion, because of attachment or because of whatever the reason is, if it sticks inside of you, right, and you keep on thinking about it afterwards, that is what is meant by grasping here. The mind is holding on to it instead of just flowing on with phenomena, moving on from one phenomena to the next one. You get stuck on a particular thing, on a particular person, on a particular object, and that being stuck can happen in at least two different ways. It can happen through desire or attachment, because you like the object, because there's some kind of attraction there. Or it can happen through aversion. You don't like it and you think about it afterwards. So this is grasping, right? So this is what we're trying to avoid. Because as soon as you grasp onto the object, then usually what happens after that is that even more desire, even more aversion tends to come into existence. You think about it in a certain way. You look at the certain qualities, right? And as you do that, aversion and desire arise even more as a consequence. So by not grasping at things, if you start grasping, your mind becomes like this yo-yo mind, going up, desiring, aversion, kind of, there's no stability there, always moving around. But if you are able to avoid the grasping and instead move, instead of kind of go with the flow, this is what mindfulness is all about, going with the flow. And you will probably see that sometimes in your meditation practice, right? When you become peaceful and suddenly it's as if you are detaching from the world. As long as you are not peaceful in your meditation, it's like you are completely immersed in the flow of thought, in the flow of phenomena, and you don't really have any perspective on what is going on. When mindfulness starts to arise, it's as if you get a sense of distance, sense of perspective. You're standing back and you're watching phenomena coming and going. Right? And sometimes if somebody else around you does something silly, right, their telephone starts to ring, you think, oh, why can't they turn off the telephone, right? Or something like that. You might get a bit irritated if somebody else does something silly like that. But once you get mindfulness, there is no more irritation because you are standing back and you're just observing. You're seeing phenomena for what they are. And irritation doesn't really arise. You're just seeing, okay, the phone is ringing. Okay, that's all that's happening. Then as soon as the phone stops ringing, you're back again, and there's no issue there. But if it upsets you that somebody's phone is ringing, then after the phone has stopped ringing, it is still a problem for you, right? And this is the problem. So this is what we're trying to avoid. We're trying instead to stand back, allow things to arise and pass away. And there's no echo in the mind afterwards of that event. And this is really what this is about here. So this is what it means to not grasp, and what it means to grasp, the idea of standing back a little bit more. You can see this very clearly in your meditation practice. Of course, in ordinary life, it can be much more difficult to achieve this, but we can at least achieve it a little bit more, right? We can move a little bit in that direction, and this is what this is really about. And I will go into quite some detail how to achieve this in ordinary life, because it is actually much more simple. Yeah, much more simple than you think. Yeah. Isn't that good news? Because sometimes we think, oh, so difficult, I can't practice this path. Actually, it is not as hard as it may sound. And I want to put quite a little bit of thought into this, how we can actually do this in the right way. And then you will see that actually everyone is able to do this. So we try to avoid grasping these things because this is kind of the thing that I was just talking about. If you leave the eye faculty unguarded, then bad is better probably, bad, unskillful qualities is better than states, because these are qualities of mind, they're not really states of mind. State sounds very kind of permanent, but it's not really permanent, of course. So there's qualities of mind coming and going, of covetousness and grief, right? And this is where I always say to people, this is where translation has gone completely wrong, right? This translation is from Venerable Nyana Moli's translation that was corrected by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, and I have a lot of respect for both of these translators, but everybody sometimes, in my opinion, makes mistakes. It's just impossible to get somebody who does things perfectly. And the reason why you get these kind of strange translations sometimes, right? I mean, just to be clear, what this really means is that you have desire or aversion for the objects of the senses. You either like the objects or you dislike them, right? So it's desire or aversion is really what it means. And then once you understand that, it's very obvious what is going on here. You see the object, desire arises or aversion arises. But if you say covetousness and grief, it just loses the whole meaning of what is going on. Grief is something you feel when somebody dies. Covetousness is a strong sense of desire that you want the belongings of other people. And it's got nothing really to do with that. And the reason why it is translated in this way is because very often what the translators do, they have one Pali word, and then they translate every Pali word with an equivalent English word. And they lock themselves into that kind of idea. One word is equivalent to another word. And because they do that, when it comes to situations like this, translations often go funny, because words in Pali do not overlap or correspond exactly to words in English. So in certain contexts, it's going to be really weird and really strange. And that is why you get these kind of things. So I don't really blame the translators, but I think it is important to be clear about what the meaning actually is. So that's what it means, desire and aversion. And these are the unwholesome qualities that arise. So what this is saying here is that you have to guard the eye faculty, because if you leave it unguarded, then these negative consequences appear, right? So what does it mean to guard the eye faculty here? And really, all it means is to have mindfulness, right? To be aware of what is happening. That is the guard. In the suttas, the mindfulness is always like the guard, the person at the city gates, allowing some people to come in, not allowing others to come in, allowing the metta and the compassion to come in, keeping out the ill will and the desire. That's the job of the guard. This is the mindfulness, right? But mindfulness itself is not enough. And this is one of those famous, I mentioned this story already, but this is the story of, for those of you who haven't been here, the story Ajahn Brahm tells of the lady. It was this lady who had a really kind of big house with lots of expensive furniture and expensive equipment inside the house. And then she had this guard on the outside of the house, right? And one day, this guard is like mindfulness. And this guard had been on the mindfulness retreat, and the lady says to him, "Well, I'm leaving today. I'm going to be away for 24 hours. Make sure you guard the house properly, right? Make sure you are really mindful of what's happening." And the guard says, "Yes, I've been on the mindfulness retreat. I know exactly what mindfulness is." So then the lady leaves, the guard is there, and in the evening the burglars arrive, right? And the guard sees the burglar. Burglar coming, burglar coming, burglar coming, mindful of burglar, mindful of burglar. Burglar going into house, burglar going into house, burglar opening the lock, taking out television, driving off with television. Wait a minute, am I supposed to do something else perhaps? Is it enough to be mindful? And this is the problem, right? If you just have mindfulness, if you just have awareness of what is going on, it is not sufficient. So this is what guarding here has, these two aspects. On the one hand, it has the aspect of mindfulness. On the other hand, it has the aspect that is known in the sutta as asampajanya, which is full awareness or clear comprehension of what is going on. And it is a asampajanya aspect that knows if what is happening is the right purpose. If it is suitable, is it suitable to allow this burglar to come into the house and steal everything? You're being paid for being the guard. Maybe you should be doing something about it, right? And this is kind of the point here. So you make sure you pay your mindfulness properly so that your mindfulness does the job and letting in the right kind of states into your mind. So this is guarding, right? Being aware to know what is going on and also knowing what is appropriate and what is not appropriate. Sati sampajanya, working together to ensure that things are guarded in the right way here. So this is what this is about. And if you don't guard these things, it says here, what happens? These bad states of desire and aversion, bad, unwholesome qualities of desire and aversion might invade him. So what does it mean that they invade you? It sounds like they're coming from inside, from outside. It sounds like some kind of, you know, aliens or something coming, invading your mind. But, of course, that's not what it means. What it means is that they arise inside of you. That's really what it means. So, again, maybe slightly unfortunate translation, because these things are all things that are already latent in our minds. We just need to allow them to give them opportunity, and they will arise as a consequence. So, because of that, because of the problems, then you practice the restraint of the eye faculty. You undertake the restraint of it, you guard the eye faculty. And the guarding here, again, is the idea of being mindful, having some degree of clear comprehension, right? Knowing what is appropriate, knowing what is not appropriate. And then the other factor here is the restraint. So once you know that, oh, I'm getting upset now, I'm getting angry, or getting a bit of ill will arising, or some desire, and you find it really disruptive in your meditation practice, then you have to restrain. So how do we restrain? And this is kind of the really interesting part here, because the problem with the word restrain is that it usually implies force in the English language. You restrain somebody, it means you hold them back using force. That's usually what it means. You take out a restraining order on somebody. Can you do that here in Malaysia? Take out a restraining order? Is that possible? Yeah? So if somebody is very kind of nuisance towards you, and they really bother you very badly, like somebody is kind of pursuing you all the time or something like that. They are a stalker, right? They have decided they have fallen in love with you, and they kind of follow you everywhere. And eventually you had enough, so you go to the court and you ask for a restraining order, and then they can't kind of go within you, within a kilometer of you or something like that. Most countries have these kind of laws, right? Because it's illegal just to follow people around in that way. So what that means, if the person comes within a kilometer of you, you call the police and you say, well, they are breaching their restraining order, and then the police comes and restrains them, holds them back, right? Okay, step outside of 1 kilometer, please. So, okay, outside the boundary. So that is restraint. So it has a lot to do with force in the English language. But what is so interesting about the suttas here, and this is why it is so important to understand the broader context of these things, in the suttas, force and using the willpower of the mind is a very minor part of restraint. Yes, it may be used sometimes to some degree, and we'll perhaps have a look at that later on, but actually it is not the most important part of restraint at all. By far more important than using willpower is to use wisdom, to use understanding, to use yonisomanasikara, to actually reflect wisely on the situation. And when you do that, then something marvelous happens. These negative things tend to fall away all by themselves. It's very interesting that wisdom power, as Ajahn Brahm calls it. I'm a disciple of Ajahn Brahm, so I use all Ajahn Brahm terminology, so please forgive me for that, but actually no need to forgive me actually at all, because I think it's all very good stuff, but the idea of wisdom power, far more powerful than willpower. Right? If you think about it, sometimes, you know, I know with myself that my personal willpower actually is sometimes so weak. You try to hold things back, you try, and eventually you get tired and you give up and you can't really do it anymore. There's some very interesting research being done on people who are able, for example, to diet, to lose weight, right? And the difference between those who are successful at dieting, well, sometimes anyway, and those who are not, is that they understand the difference between wisdom power and willpower. And one of the experiments they did was for somebody, how did it work again? It was something about a nice cake, some kind of nice cake or something in the window of a shop or at a bakery or something like that. And then people were supposed to walk past this window, and they were hungry or something like that. And then how were people able to bypass this window without kind of just popping into the shop and buying some of these beautiful cakes, right? Especially if you're hungry, those cakes look so delicious when you're hungry. So, and I think they were for free as well, but you're supposed to, something like that. I can't remember the exact story. But the interesting thing was that there was two different types of people. And there were the people who, when they walked past the window, they always had to look at those cakes, right? And the moment you looked at those cakes, your willpower had it. It was shot. It was almost impossible to restrain yourself. You were hungry. The cakes were delicious. They were for free, right? Your best friend was behind the counter ready to give it to you. It was impossible to hold back. You just couldn't do it, even though you're supposed to be on a diet. Those people who were successful were the ones who knew that as soon as you look at those cakes, you are finished. So they didn't even look. They would look in a different direction, distract themselves, right? That was the wisdom power, because they understood the inherent weakness of human willpower. And this is actually a very beautiful insight, because it leads us, it teaches us how to live in the world, how to enable us to actually stop doing things that we know are harmful. We use wisdom. We don't kind of yield to the temptation of just looking, right? And we actually stay completely away from those things. We make it difficult for ourselves to be tempted by those things that we know are harmful in the long run. And this is one of those tricks that we do. And this is one of the reasons why also it is so useful for monastics to live in the forest. Once you live in the forest and you withdraw yourself from the world, it is more difficult to be tempted by those things. You need less willpower to be able to continue the monastic life. If you live in the city, if you live tempted by sensual things all the time, it is much more difficult to sustain it because your willpower is going to be worn down after a while. So this is the distinction between willpower and wisdom power. Exactly. You are very sharp there. You got it right. So this is the difference. And one of the interesting things as well is that if you use a lot of willpower, after a while you get tired, right? Your mind just can't deal with it anymore. It has been shown in other experiments that some of the people who use a lot of willpower at work, and most of us have to use a certain amount of willpower in our daily life. You go to work, you have to read something, you have to write something, right? Maybe it's not very thing that you really want to read or write. Sometimes these things are really boring, but you have to do it. The only way you can do it is use a certain amount of willpower, right? Or a classic example are the air traffic controllers at airports. The people who sit in those high towers and they kind of, watching all the traffic going on there. Apparently it's a very high degree of concentration required, because you always have to be alert. If you're not alert, some very serious disasters could happen, right? So air traffic control apparently is a very high concentration demand on the people who work. And often they are very exhausted when they're finished with work. And that is because they have to force to use willpower onto the thing that they are observing. And of course, as you do that, it makes you tired. And when you become tired, your ability to exert willpower is highly reduced, and after a while you just give up. And so that is the first problem with willpower. It always exhausts you, and at the end of the day it makes you give up on what you're doing. And the second problem with using willpower, especially if we suppress things, if we hold them down, is that as soon as you let go, right, what happens? Bang, it comes back up again. And this is the problem with willpower. It's a bit like a kettle that is boiling and you hold the lid, right? And after a while, if you lift it, it kind of explodes up again. It's a similar kind of idea almost. And that is why wisdom power is so powerful. Because with wisdom power, it is more difficult in the sense that it takes more time to kind of get used to it. It takes more time, more reflection to understand what the wisdom is. And that is the hard part with wisdom, is the reflection that goes into it and the kind of the understanding that goes into it. But once you get the idea, once you get the hang of it, once you understand that certain things are harmful, then you use that wisdom to turn away from those things. And then when you use that wisdom, first of all, much less effort is required. It doesn't tire out your mind. But secondly, what it does, it really ends that unwholesome quality completely. You're not just suppressing it, you're actually ending it on the spot. And it disappears for a fairly long period of time. Yeah, so this is wisdom power versus willpower. And this is really what restraint here is all about. So now hopefully you're getting some idea of restraint. I'm going to be saying the same thing many, many times. Many of the suttas that we're going to look at are precisely about this. I'm going to repeat myself endlessly. So when I see you starting to snore, I'll try to kind of see if we can kind of make slight variations on the theme. But it's good to repeat these kind of things, because these are really important and crucial central aspects on the Buddhist path. How to use wisdom in a practical way to make our minds more even, go through life in an even, beautiful, kind of with a nice mind state, which is kind of smooth, that's right, and kind of whoa, and things are so much more easy as a consequence. So that is the eye faculty, right? And no surprise, the same thing is true for all the other faculties. I'll just read through this briefly and then just briefly comment on the last part here. So, on hearing a sound with the ear, on smelling an odor with the nose, on tasting a flavor with the tongue, on touching a tangible with a body, on cognizing a mind object with a mind. He does not grasp onto the object or its features, since if he left the mind unguarded by mindfulness, bad, unskillful qualities of desire and aversion might arise in him. Because of that, he practices the wisdom power and a little bit of willpower, but not too much. And he guards the mind faculty with mindfulness and also with full awareness and clear comprehension, satisampajanya. He undertakes the holding back through wisdom power of the mind faculty. Possessing this noble restraint, the noble restraint of the faculties, he experiences within himself a bliss that is unsullied. So here we see the same thing with all the senses, right? So any kind of arising of these bad, unskillful qualities, wherever they arise, doesn't matter where it is, even if it just arises in the mind, right? It's the same procedure that we use to overcome it. And this is in daily life when we go about our daily things, but it's also in your meditation practice. Sometimes you meditate and these things come up, right? And you know, sometimes they come up very often, sometimes whatever. So you have the possibility of dealing with these things. And you will find, generally speaking, it's easier to deal with it in meditation than in daily life. There's less things going on. So in a sense, meditation can be considered a kind of a learning ground, how to deal with these things. But then, as you deal with them in meditation, then you can also use the same thing also in your daily life as well. Otherwise, sometimes it's the other way around. You learn how to do it in daily life, and then you also bring it into your meditation. There isn't really any right way of doing this. Either way is fine. And when you do that, then you have the restraint of the faculties. You experience within yourself the bliss that is unsullied. It is not dirtied. It is clean kind of bliss. Before we saw the bliss of blamelessness, you feel blameless, but because there is still aversion and desire arising in the mind, it's as if that bliss is kind of dirtied a little bit by the desire and the ill will, right? And aversions. The idea here is to have a more pure kind of bliss, and that is why it's called the bliss that is unsullied. Abhyaseka sukha is a Pali word. Abhyaseka is actually quite a rare word, but it occurs here. And then you feel the sense of purity inside of yourself. Not only are you blameless, but you also feel a sense of purity, and that kind of increases the experience of being blameless. This is a higher kind of happiness, right? Every step forward you move on the path, the more deep and profound and pure and delightful is that happiness that you experience. So one step up, bit more happiness. And of course, this is why it is really worth doing, because it gives you something profound, something beautiful, a development of the mind in the right direction. This is why this is so worthwhile. Only thing really worth doing in life, right? Everything else is kind of stupid in comparison. This is it. This is what life is all about, at least as far as I'm concerned. And hopefully I can convince you a little bit of the same thing, because in my opinion, it is such a beautiful teaching, a beautiful way of looking at life and what is really important. Anyway, it is already 10:30. Let's have a short break, and we'll come back and see you again at 10:45.